Hi there, and welcome to Online Gods, a podcast about digital cultures in India and beyond. This month, we're speaking with Carol McGranahan about lies, and with Atul Khatri about comedy. Online communication lends itself pretty well to both lying and telling jokes. There's something about the combination of simultaneity, masses of fleeting information, and interconnectivity that gives lies and jokes a different type of life online. And today, it's lies and comedy that we'll be discussing. For those of you who are new to the podcast, I'd like not only to recommend that you go back and dig into the early episodes, but also tell you a little bit about what we do. So each iteration, we speak to an academic about a concept somehow relating to media, and also an online god, a person who uses new media in an influential or interesting way. And so this month in the concept section, we have Carol McGranahan to talk about lying and lies online, and also comedian Atul Khatri to talk about telling jokes online, what it's like to be a comedian who does a lot of his work in the digital sphere. This podcast is part of a wider project on digital dignity, which is run by Sahan Udupa out of LMU in Munich and is co-published by the How Network for Ethnographic Theory. There are lies, damn lies, podcast download statistics, and politicians' Twitter feeds. Those of us who follow politicians online are probably not oversurprised to see a few half-truths or glosses every now and again. I mean, just yesterday when I was busy thanking our listeners as we passed the 50,000 unique download mark for a month, I noticed a British politician pretend to be upset, some might say lying, in order to score political points against their rival. Well, what should we make of politicians lying online? How can we understand it and put it into some wider cultural context? Well, to answer this question, Sahana spoke to Carol McGranahan after she caught up with her following the Global Digital Media Cultures and Extreme Speech International Workshop at LMU Munich. Now, if I spend a little bit too much time checking how many people are downloading this podcast, then Carol spends at least as much time following Donald Trump's Twitter feed. Aside from this, she's also a professor at the University of Colorado and is probably best known for her fieldwork in Tibet. But of course, she also conducts online ethnography, which is what you're going to talk about today. I'll put all the links relevant to her work on the website.
Thank you very much, Carol, for joining us. Mm-hmm. In your work on Trump's lies on Twitter, you make an argument around what you define as an archive of lies. What is this archive of lies and how are social networking sites enabling it?
Excellent. All right. So I think first the important thing is to say is what is an archive, right? So an archive, if we think of it as a documentary collection for assembling history, and historically that has been in the hands of a authoritative force, whether it's the government or an institution, where historians have gone to write history. And recently, in the last several decades, anthropologists have decided to turn their sights on the archive as well, to think, what can we as anthropologists do in the archive? So we have Michel Rovtrio, Silencing the Past, a very famous book, looking at how how archives produce both histories, but also silences, right? Like all that is not produced, and purposefully so. And then the work of, very influential work of Anne Laura Stoller. I'm thinking of archives not just as sources, but archives as subjects in and of themselves, as well as field sites where we can go in as ethnographers. So Anne Stoller thinks of archives as epistemological experiments, she writes once, through which both dispositions, but also ideas of common sense become normalized, right? So very much doing that work of the status quo, and saying that an anthropologist in stepping into the archives would actually have some different questions to ask than historians. So looking at the way that data is organized and cataloged, looking at the cultural logics behind that, at the conceptual scaffolding in terms of what gets filed where, you know, why this file and not that one, and saying this is about not just right, producing, but also legitimating, right, and normalizing certain senses, of say, to use her term, following Foucault, of the order of things, right, the way that things are supposed to be. So can we take this sense of the governmental or institutional archive and go to social media, right? Can we call Twitter an archive? I am joining with communication scholars to say, yes, we can. So actually some scholars based here in Germany, Axel Brunzing and Katrin Weller have argued that historians, but I think scholars in general, haven't really recognized the importance of social media as a historical source versus, say, one for the study of speech or communication. And so they argue about the historical importance of user-generated content, right? Of something we haven't quite seen in the same way before. It's not quite, the Natalie Davis's Pardon Tales, but an equivalent of some kind. And they even go so far as calling Twitter a first draft of the present. All right. So what I'm thinking, as someone who's not just a scholar of Twitter, but also a user of Twitter, so someone who's been participating on the platform for a while, Twitter is public. It is social. It's egalitarian. It's a place where ordinary people can interact with public figures, including someone like Donald Trump. So Donald Trump has been an active Twitter user for almost a decade. He started in 2009. So he has been on the platform for quite some time. And given what we know of Trump as a politician, a reality TV figure, a businessman, we know that his speech patterns include not just truths, but also exaggerations and lies. So I think the question then becomes to take what Hannah Arendt taught us, so clearly that politicians lie, and in so doing, the purposeful public lie in the hands of a politician works to unsettle history, right? Works to ground it in a new way. And yet Trump truly goes beyond any sort of hegemonic understanding we might have or even practice of politicians lying, right? His lies just exceed, those certainly of any other U.S. president. But so how do we then consider an archive of historical documents that are not just interested, right, in the sense of serving a government or serving an institution, but are themselves not truthful from the very beginning. And Twitter, of course, has embraced Trump. He brings lots of users to the platform. He brings journalists, to come to see what he has done. They've almost rewritten the rules entirely, it seems, for Trump. So in December of 2017, Trump released new rules governing all sorts of behavior on the platform, but including for hateful conduct. And they basically said that if you are using putting up tweets that in other contexts or by other users might be considered hateful, but you are a government figure posting something newsworthy, then we're going to let it pass, right? So in my mind, this is, given the current political moment, in some ways, this is the Trump exception, that Twitter has made.
Wonderful. And then you also talk about history as extreme speech, which means that we are not looking at the history of extreme speech. But when you look at the lies and the archive of lies, then you argue that history itself becomes extreme speech. Right. So can you just elaborate on this a bit more?
Yeah, exactly. Well, so this is, again, if your archive is composed of lies that are themselves a form of extreme speech, like pulling us in one direction, right, past the acceptable, past the normative, then what sort of history can be written from that? So an archive sets the tone, it sets content, it sets form, it sets so many things, right, for history in ways often that of which we're unaware. We already know from interdisciplinary scholars, but certainly from anthropologists, that categories found in discourse compel social action, right? They bring people together in groups. They have elements of sociality that are really dear to them, but that can both compel action in positive ways, but also in violent ways. So the categories of fear, categories of othering around, certain aspects of identity, whether it has to do with religion in the case of Islamophobia, whether it has to do with Trump speaking to the list is long, but whether it's Mexicans and illegal immigrants in the United States, whether it's anyone basically who goes against his policies or his words. We've already seen the ways in which statements by Donald Trump have actually compelled public action on behalf of private citizens against others, right? So rumor, exaggeration, lies, are not neutral forms of speech, right? They're utterances that actually get translated into, at times, unfortunately, violent action. Given that Trump is not just any user of Twitter, however, but is the U.S. president, I think then this becomes an even more important, you know, question of what we already know. We already know that the work of lies specifically is social, right? That it's lies involve affiliative truths, right? That you can believe in something because you want to and then link up with others, right? Who share this same belief, right? There's this aspirational sense in some ways to the lies that Trump tells, right? That creates a social bond. Sometimes it's a social bond of people who are repelled by him rather than compelled, but on both sides, right? That we see this. And so given this, I think it's not just a history of lying or a history of extreme speech, but history as, mm-hmm. right, lies and extreme speech. And this is something that we as scholars, right, need to go in on both fronts, both the of front, but very much also the as front, and to take that just as seriously.
Very much, very much. I think this also brings me to my work on online volunteers of Hindu nationalism. Mm-hmm. There is a great zeal to assemble facts, figures, and treatises on online media to as a counterpoint to the mainstream media narrative and to legacy critics dubbed as pseudo-seculars.
Yeah.
So they would have a large amount of data on, for instance, riot statistics. Mm-hmm. So whenever a journalist goes wrong, makes a mistake, then they would brandish this as the correct fact. Right. And they are archiving all these different narratives and so-called facts to contest the so-called pseudo-liberal media and legacy critics. Right. So this is some kind of, you know, bottom-up archiving practice.
Yes.
And that creates what you define as affiliated truths. And it also creates a kind of community. And speaking of online communities, there are many different concepts now, networked publics, affective publics. And I'm just trying to link this argument about archiving and the other point you make about coevalness in online experiences that create a community around shared beliefs.
Yes.
Right? So can you just elaborate that, elaborate on how coevalness in online experiences and this kind of lying can create a community?
Sure. Yeah, this is something I've been thinking about for a while. So in addition to my this current research I'm doing on Trump, I'm also a longtime ethnographer and historian, anthropologist of Tibet. And so do a lot of research with the Tibetan community, including online research. And so it's something that I think first wrote about 5 years ago, was what I realized was that social media had become an ethnographic space, right? In terms of that sense of shared sensibility, that we are in this together and that you are sharing, but whether it's the mundane aspects of your day, things you feel passionate about. So things that are both poignant and things that are entirely banal, right? Which is what ethnography is like when you're in the field, right? It's sharing, as we know, the minutiae, the imponderabilia of everyday life, as well as things that are deeply, you know, meaningful to you. So what I realized was that social media was enabling this new sense of ethnographic connection, kind of among people. And I immediately thought of Johann Fabian's, you know, classic work, Time and the Other, where he basically posits the idea of coevalness of people sharing the same temporality or historicity, right? As a critique of the Boasian ethnographic presence. So saying we are all in the same, you know, historical time that is unfolding. And what I was realizing is that we are this new form of coevalness is actually a shared participatory community, right? Enabled by social media, that ability to connect in groups, especially in a political sense is what I was seeing. Now, I was seeing this in a positive sense in terms of activists making horizontal connections, you know, with others in different struggles for social justice or for political issues or environmental issues, in terms of coming together, knowing each other, learning about the other's struggle, and making connections that were moving them forward. But in that same, almost Benedict Anderson sense of imagining that community who you will never meet face to face, but feeling that sense of solidarity and thinking, social media is a new form of coevalness.
Absolutely. In your work, you build ethnography of archives as a research method. Mm-hmm. So how do we do this? And how can ethnography handle the online material, online archives, in a completely different manner from data, big data analytics, data visualization methods, which are becoming quite prominent in recent times? So how does an ethnographer look at online archives differently?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So exactly, I'm trying to use an ethnography in the archives method here, which is one that was pioneered by Anne Laura Stoller, to bring ethnographic sensibilities to the colonial archives, right? To say, again, how do we do ethnographic research when we can't have the face-to-face in-person conversations that have been the hallmark of ethnographic participant observation for so long, right? How do we take the sensibilities of that thinking and of that commitment to coming to know another on their own terms into the archives. And as Anne's work has shown for so long, it's about trying to inhabit, to recognize, to name, and to start feeling cultural rhythms and logics, to get to that embodied experiential sense by coming to know the people who are authoring the documents, those who are writing in the marginalia, which we might think of as a retweet, right, in some ways, or a response, right? So there's ways to kind of approximate the written document in terms of how it works on Twitter. But to think of it as a lived, situated practice of people actually living their lives, right? So all of the quantitative and even much of the qualitative methods that are used currently to do research on platforms such as Twitter are invaluable for many things. What they don't give us a sense of often are actual people as users, right? Instead, people appear as demographics, right? They're fit into a box of some sort, whether it's user by age or gender or nationality or number of times they tweet or so all sorts of things that can be really useful in terms of understanding whether it's big questions or even little questions. But I think complementing that sort of data with really focused ethnographic data that goes in and tries to look at the way that individual users, and it can be quite a large sample size if you want, are actually using the platform, has great actually online application. So if ethnography in the archives as a method is designed to bring ethnographic sensibilities to a situation where you cannot have face-to-face conversations, right? Twitter seems to be an excellent example for that. Now, the participatory nature of ethnography means that you as ethnographer can be interacting and should be interacting. And in fact, as I argue, and most anthropologists would, it's not ethnography if there's not some sort of participation and if there's only observation. Mm-hmm. But what we can do is see how people are receiving, how they are responding, how they're reproducing, challenging, right, in their own words, and look at, you can follow chains of tweets. You can follow ones in your own user group, right, your own timeline, not just through hashtag searches. And for me, that's actually been really crucial, the organic nature of watching the communities with which I am already a member. So whether it's activists or academics or all sorts of that. So hashtag searches provide certain sort of information that's actually can be often disconnected somewhat from community. If you are as a researcher are participating in the community, then you're going to have a different sense of what's going on because the tweets that are appearing in your timeline are from people you've come to know. Mm-hmm. So again, we're approximating that ethnographic knowledge mm-hmm. and the context, the situatedness mm-hmm. of who the people are who are participating mm-hmm. in the conversation beyond just a demographic, but knowing them as people in some way.
That's right. And also, some way of replicating the ethnographic field in the online space, right?
Right.
Here you are creating your networks and you are able to closely watch how these groups develop
and how they interact. You're watching individuals relate with each other, but in this expanded sphere. You know, it's not just watching, you're participating in it, mm-hmm. but watching the many, branches of the tree kind of as it grows and watching people interact or a tweet you've already seen retweeted a couple times and a third and watching where the conversation goes and all of the various possibilities mm-hmm. for the ways that kind of the pulse of the archive in terms of Twitter as an archive, is driven by the users. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think losing that sense of the real people. Now, okay, let's not talk about Russian bots, but go to the place where we're actually, looking at the way actual people are using Twitter, right?
Right.
That this is created. Yes, there is Twitter, the company, but then looking at the users, right? And looking mm-hmm. at the way that people are bringing these, not just the relationships, but the knowledge and the possibility that's embedded in them kind of forward.
Absolutely. And ethnographer herself becomes an avid online user.
Right.
And that brings me to my last question. How long do you spend on Twitter every day?
Oh, gosh. My favorite thing about Twitter is that Twitter is absolutely like opt in, opt out. There's no commitment to it, right? There's no requirement to follow others. It's not, you know, you don't have to, I follow you, you follow me. You don't have that. But in addition, you don't need to check in on Twitter, you know, every day and feel like you're missing something. You could just drop in, show up as needed. I tend to check in the morning. Is when I do, but I don't stay on Twitter all day. You know, and that's one of the great things of it is that it's truly a platform that you can use in your own way. There's no expectation, it seems to me, from others because there isn't that mutual, that there's not really the reciprocal nature that you might find on Facebook. And so instead there's the sense of obligation is actually less, I find, than on other platforms.
Right. Thank you very much your time, Carol.
I really love this interview. I think Carol made a load of really interesting points. I think the one that really stuck with me most was related to social media as a shared space, but also as a shared time. And this temporal aspect, being together online at the same time, I think is vital for understanding why online communication functions the way it does. And if it's true for more solid online communities, then I think it's also true to a certain extent, maybe a lesser extent, to those of us who share moments, you know, experience the news or current affairs together by either experiencing or commenting online. And this is certainly true when it comes to making erudite or witty comments in relation to fresh news, something that comedians who make jokes online have to be truly skillful at. Well, our next guest, comedian Atul Khatri, has been doing it for a really long time. So let's see what he has to say about it. Atul Khatri became a comedian late in life at the age of 43. And now you see him online in sketches alongside much younger faces in the East India comedy group and also in his own videos, either specially made or taken from his shows. And if you're in India, you might have seen his face on adverts for various products. His comedy is mostly observational, dealing with his own identity as a Sindhi, or rather a horny Sindhi, as his pseudonym suggests, and also with political and social issues alongside anything else he can make jokes about. Hi, Atul, and thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you so much for having me over.
Great. My first question is to do with the, I suppose, the subversive potential of comedy in India. I mean, you do a lot of observational comedy, sometimes dealing with social and political issues. Do you think Yes. comedians like yourself are good for democracy in India?
Yes, I think we are required. So what happens is that that sometimes, you know, in the absence of an opposition to the government, okay, people like comedians, writers, poets, all of us sometimes have to, you know, look out for the government and also always, you know, sort of highlight what mistakes they are doing. Mm-hmm. Because I think we have in some way have to act like an opposition to the ruling government, you know, in our own little way, in our own social media networks, just trying to, you know, I wouldn't say educate, but I would just say like to just highlight some of the, you know, problems which they don't address. So I definitely think in a democracy, people like us do have a very important role to play.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thanks. I mean, and I was thinking about that. You're saying like you go onto a stage. When you go onto a stage, you've got a few hundred, maybe a few thousand people. And then, but then your videos online, some of them are watched by, you know, millions of people, right? And, and some of those people who are watching get really angry. I'm thinking I've seen this yes. Diwali carol that you did with the East India comedy group and the Arnab song. Arnab is a, Arnab Goswami, for those people who don't know the Indian context, is a Indian television news anchor who likes to get angry at people on the left.
He's like Fox News on cocaine.
Yes, exactly. And or this morning I saw on your Facebook you were posting about the Namo app, which is basically making fun of the Prime Minister and the ruling party and so on. So when yes. you when all these people get really angry at you, do you worry at all?
Not really worry. So what really it has made our jobs a little bit more, I would say. We have to be very smart of telling the joke without really hurting somebody. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you can, you know, So you have to say in a very light manner, like, and honestly, to be very honest with you, as a human being, as a person, as an Indian, I feel all politicians are same. It's currently the BJP government, since you spoke about the NAMO up, they are in rule, they are in power today, or some other government is in my opinion, they're all the same. They're just out there to, you know, make money, and, you know, very few people really deliver in their cabinet. You know, if you see, if you just Google it, you know, half these guys have got so many criminal cases pending against them, you know. So sorry to say, our state is such that, so it's not really targeted towards this. So like, I've been putting Facebook posts, tweets since like 2010, when the earlier ruling party, and if you see my post that time, or against the Congress also, which was ruling at that time, it is not really, it's very anti-established, really, to be say, or where we feel, and when good things happen, we say good things about it as well, you know. Like, for example, the Narendra Modi government had started this Clean India initiative, you know, a few years back. Mm-hmm. Now, in my opinion, that's an amazing thing, because first time, a national leader was going on platform and saying, hey, let's clean India. We haven't done it. It's such a very simple thing, you know. Most of us are very apolitical, to be honest with you. And if we do get backlash, so see, sometimes people don't. But today, I'll tell you what happens is, I tell this example today, everybody has a smartphone in the hand.
Mm-hmm.
Every person has a device in his hand. So he also has a, he or she has a tool to, you know, to give an opinion for your opinion. So I think it's okay, as long as they don't get too abusive about it, or, you know, if as long as it's a healthy discussion, it's okay. But you know, trolls are there everywhere. You know, you can say anything. You can say that it's a lovely, you know, bright sunshine day today, and still there'll be six guys on your post. You'll say, no, hey, you're wrong. Where I am, it's raining. So how dare you say it's a lovely day? You know. So I think people get up in the morning and say, hey, offend me somehow. You know, so they sit to the microscope and watch your every Facebook post and tweet, and they want to sort of get something negative out of it for no rhyme or reason.
There was one of the comments underneath one of your videos was, somebody wrote, he single-handedly offended all of the communities, ... but really creatively, man. Like, you know, so it's fine. I guess if you spread your offense around, then then it's okay.
Yeah.
But do you worry about...
And then what happens is these guys try to get a lot of other people on their side. Mm-hmm. Just so, you know, I had put up a video about Justin Bieber concert, which I attended with my daughters, and I hated it. And it was a rant, which I put up on. It's one of my YouTube videos. Mm-hmm. And there were guys like from villages messaging me in India that, hey, how dare you insult Justin Bieber? I said, listen, do you think Justin Bieber is your problem? You don't have electricity in your town. You know, mm-hmm. You don't have proper roads. And you're getting offended for a Justin Bieber concert, which I attended. So I think people's priorities have to change.
Mm-hmm. I feel really sorry for you. You had to go to a Justin Bieber concert.
Yes.
Changing track a little bit, I wanted to ask you about language. I lived for a couple of years in South India, so I never learned any Hindi, just Kannada. And so when I'm watching yours and many other comedians' routines, I'm following what's going on, getting most of the cultural references, but then the punchline's in Hindi, and I miss the punchline. So why so often do you and other comedians do the build up to the joke, you know, in English, and the punchline in Hindi? Yeah,
I don't know. To be honest with you, when I write it, in my case, I'm just saying what I don't really think that I have to put the setup in English. It's probably how I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I do a lot of Hinglish, as you know, in my daily conversation with mm-hmm. my wife or with my children. So it's more it comes from that, rather than you know, writing with the purpose that, okay, I'll do the premise in English and do the punchline in Hindi. But there are some Hindi words which are so deep, you know, one word can mean so many things. It's just more funnier when you deliver it in Hindi. And finally, what we are, you know, sort of living in India, and the stand-up comedy genre is really sort of, people are liking it. And in fact, the last year, the biggest rise of stand-up comedy has been in Hindi language. So there are a lot of comedians earlier who used to do in English, but now they've shifted to Hindi, and they're doing particularly well, because just that the subscriber base just rises exponentially. Since you've dealt with South India, I have a friend of mine who used to do it in English. Now he has a 1-hour set in Tamil.
Uh-huh.
I went to Hyderabad recently, and there was an open mic of comedy, which was in Telugu, which is a local language in Telangana, mm-hmm. Andhra Pradesh. So I think the next phase is going to be of people who are going to now, you know, doing it in their own regional language, because you have to really understand India has got so many languages, so many cultures, and some jokes are best delivered in that particular mother language or mother tongue which is there.
And do you think there'll be then a shift in the sort of audiences that, that then you can reach? Because you need a certain sort of education level, sophistication of English to follow, you know, like comedy, of course, in any language. So now you think we're doing it in local languages, you think you're going to escape the sort of, I suppose, metropolitan bubble? I mean, when I look at the, you know, I'm just trying to guess by looking at the crowd, you know, on the YouTube videos, they seem pretty affluent, you know, cosmopolitan.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there are two things to this. One is, so we have to understand that India has a very young population. You know, I think 40 or 50% of India's population is under the age of 25. So we have a very young population who are using these technologies, who are using YouTube, Facebook, you know, all these other platforms which are there.
Mm-hmm.
So they have, so that way we have been very lucky because they are really a target audience, which is there, number one. Number two, what has happened is thanks to, you know, India last year has seen the launch of this world's largest 4G network called Jio, which everybody has a super fast 4G network on the handheld phone, and they're consuming this kind of data. So what has really happened is that earlier, probably 6 years, 7 years back, there used to be a difference between the kid in a city like Mumbai and Delhi was vis-a-vis a city in probably Hyderabad or a Lucknow in UP, smaller cities, because, you know, there was a gap of information. But today, honestly, there is that all those walls have crumbled. Today, a kid in Bombay or a kid in Hyderabad or a kid in Lucknow or a kid in a small city in India is as much tuned in as to what anybody else is.
You mentioned how technology enables now, you know, jokes to travel or information to travel. Is there a pressure because of now everything is so instant, right? You know, something happens and then people expect automatically people to have a commentary on it or a critique on it, or in your case, a joke on it, you know? So do you, absolutely, you know, wake up in the morning, look at the news and go, oh, now I need to find something funny to say about, you know, X, Y, Z, whatever happened in the morning?
So actually, Ian, honestly, the reason I personally got into stand-up comedy because I used to do this for years together. So I got into comedy because I used to put up funny posts on what is happening around me on Facebook and on Twitter. So I've been doing it since like 2010, whenever Facebook sort of came in. There was earlier Orkut, but I never went to Orkut. But when Facebook really came in, because so I used to do that ever before I got into comedy. In fact, that is one of the reasons I got into stand-up comedy, because when I used to put up these funny Facebook posts on what are things happening around, and people used to tell me, hey, you're very funny, you're very original, why don't you get into stand-up comedy? And in fact, when a lot of friends started saying that, I said, hey, I should probably start looking at stand-up comedy. And that's when I went for my first open mic, thanks to all these constant posts or comments by my friends saying that, hey, you should get into stand-up comedy. You are very original. You are very funny. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people say, okay, we get up early in the morning, we see your Facebook posts, we read them, and then we again log in after 2 hours to see what you've written about the next thing which has happened. I still get a lot of requests. So if some news breaks out within a day, I get a lot of requests on my direct messaging saying that, hey, why haven't you commented, or why can you make a joke on this? You know? So I think as comedians on stage also, when we go, we have to be abreast of what is happening around. We can't be, you know, we should know what's happening in Donald within the US or what's happening around the world, you know. So I think that's very important for any comedian to sort of know, because when you get on stage, you know, you have a person, a front row guy sitting from America, you should be able to talk to him about, you know, how this porn star has recently, you know, gone after him, after Donald Trump or anything. So that's I think that's very important for anybody for that matter.
So you have some sort of...
And also you have to realize what is happening is with tools like WhatsApp, which India really is a big follower of WhatsApp, you know, the amount of information which is thrown to you every day, you know, when a news breaks out, you anyway have after half an hour some, you know, jokes hitting you about that.
Yeah.
So what has also made our role very difficult as a comedian, that your jokes have to rise above those jokes, because if you go and say simple jokes, people say, hey, listen, we heard this on WhatsApp, it's all over the place now, you know, we want to hear your more intelligent take on it. So it has even made our lives more difficult that way.
That's really interesting. And does this happen quite often? And you write a joke, you put it out there, and then you see someone else has made that joke, you know, already, like 20 minutes before you. Then what would you do? You delete your joke and think of a better one? Or how does it work?
No, so sometimes same thoughts would come. So as long as you're not really stealing the joke. So, I mean, for example, when whatever news hit, suppose when demonetization happened in India, you know, last year, 2016 November, what happened was every 10 minutes you were getting like 10 jokes on WhatsApp and on Facebook and things like that, you know. So sometimes jokes, the thoughts are same, the premises are same, but, you know, joke could be different. But finally, what you deliver on stage is something which has to get, which has to be beyond that, which has to be more. So most stand-up comedians follow the thing where you try to make it very personal, you know. So I had an entire set on demonetization on YouTube, which is there, which is basically, I released it after a year after demonetization happened, but still the jokes were very fresh because that was something which happened very personally to me and people could relate to that.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Just for people who aren't aware, demonetization was, they should watch your YouTube video, but it was a moment about a year or so ago, on Bitmore, right, in India, where a lot of the big banknotes, the two biggest banknotes, were basically taken out of circulation, and it's caused
the 500 rupee and the 1,000 rupee notes were overnight, within hours. Prime Minister came on TV and he said that these notes are illegal tender. So it threw the entire country, because this happened in India, like, after many, many years. I think this happened somewhere in the 60s. It had happened earlier. And now it was more, initiative to curb corruption.
So how to say, in terms of, I suppose, your contribution to, I suppose, democracy or public debate and so on, you do a great job. Comedians do a great job, right, at highlighting the ridiculousness of a situation or so on. Can comedy go further? Can it be, you know, also a source for positive change, or does it stop basically at the I want to say negative, because that's an important thing, but, you know, does it stop at the critique, or can it, like, you know, suggest things as
well? No, it can go beyond that. So, for example, in East India comedy, we used to do this thing called outrage, okay, which was political, you know, comedy.
Yeah.
Outrage was, if people can just follow on East India comedy, outrage. So it was more of, again, we were looking at a lot of social messages also. So, example, there was a colleague of mine, Sapan Verma. At that time, he spoke about student suicides which were happening. You know, people who were committing suicides because of parental pressure, because of pressure from college, especially in the IITs and in the, you know, higher, grades or in the professional courses. So Sapan had a very interesting take on that. Obviously, there was humor in it, but also it was a very serious talk. At the end of it, a lot of comedians came on camera and said, listen, hey, I'm an engineer. I did IIT, but today I'm a comedian. So it's okay. You know, grades don't matter. So Sapan did that. So I had a thing on which was very passionate. So I'm very, right from as a kid, I was very passionate about saving water for some reason. I don't know. There was something always inculcated by my parents there to save water. So, for example, I never have a bath in a shower. I always use a bucket and water, because I use always one bucket for a bath. So I use that platform to talk about the water crisis, not only in India, but across the world. So I wrote an EIC outrage about water conservation. In my own funny way, I tried to convey the thing. Now, when I wrote that, I got a lot of messages from fans, followers, who said, sir, thank you for telling me. After you told me that, even I have started having a bath with a bucket instead of sitting under the shower for minutes, hours, you know.
I
travel in a 5-star hotel, when I go for shows, I make it a point to call up the housekeeping and ask them for a bucket, so that I personally hate water anywhere in the world, you know, because it's like liquid gold.
This is my last question, because I was thinking about the sort of stuff that you guys do, and then I was thinking in America, it's very popular now, you know, with John Oliver, or, you know, all of these people, that these are the people who are really talking then about these big serious issues. These are the people who are, in a way, are providing an opposition, like you say. I was wondering why, I mean, like, is it a space that opened up because the press, TV and print press, failed to do their job, and you comedians basically stepped in and said, okay, well, if you're not doing it, then we're doing it. Why do you think it's like a global moment, in a way, that, like, comedians have sort of taken the mantle of being, you know, serious opposition, in a way?
First of all, I think the platforms have come for us to do that. Okay, so today it's very easy for anybody to record something on his own mobile phone, and it could go viral. It could reach millions within days, you know. So I think, first of all, those platforms have come in. We have access. 8 years back, there was no way I could have expressed an opinion rather than telling a group of friends over a dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So first of all, these platforms have come in, which have made it very, very easy for people to, to share this news, your opinion. And if it's really strong, if it's something of worth to it, I think it will travel on its own merits, number one. Number two, what has also happened is, you see across the world, media houses, journalists, TV channels have started taking sides, they are getting, they sometimes, you know, align with the ruling party, or sometimes they are totally in opposition. So they sometimes don't give a very fair opinion of what is really happening. You know, and we have seen it, you know, we see it in the US, you see it everywhere in the world. As I said earlier, all of us, most of us people are apolitical. You know, today I'll tell you, in India, we have a lot of more issues. I have a lot of personal issues rather than, you know, like, I want to see that the road outside my house is perfect. You know, my children come home safe in the night after partying.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the really issues which everybody has. Nobody really wants to get into politics. But when these guys don't do anything, we have to, you know, stand up, and get together. You know, as I think it's a responsibility of a citizen also to sort of be aware of what's happening and just not, you know, just always blame the government for it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been really great having you on the podcast.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you so much.
I thought that was a really insightful interview, not least because I think Atul's sense of resigned duty to call out the political class. It's like no one else is doing it, so comedians have to. And I think there's something really fascinating in what he said here. And I think it's something we're only really starting to understand. You know, comedy as political critique in the so-called digital age seems to be the most critical commentary around. It seems to work much better than the po-faced stuff when it comes to calling out those in power. But I do worry a little bit about his potential. Whether you like him or not, for instance, you have to admit that Trump was laughed at a lot and continuously, but he simply rode on through it. I wonder if people took him more seriously, whether things would have played out differently. Like, what are the limits to comedy? What can it do and what can't it do? Anyway, this is something definitely worth exploring in the future as we continue on our journey into new media in India and beyond. I got a really nice email about 10 days back from Usha Raman. She teaches at the University of Hyderabad in the Department of Communication. And at the moment, she's teaching a course on digital culture. Has a website, digitalculturedoc.wordpress.com, which you should check out. Not least because she had students who were taking a class listen to this podcast, the past episodes, and post their thoughts. And it was really wonderful to read such detailed, thoughtful, and articulate responses to the podcast. Even when the students disagreed with the way I framed stuff or what we did, it was still really interesting to get that sort of sustained feedback, which you don't usually get, I suppose, outside a class of people, inquiring minds. And so this was really great. And I wanted to read just part of one of the posts by somebody who just signed themselves as Vaish K. And I'm guessing they have more of a name than that. But I want to read their response to the very first podcast that we put out then. The very first podcast we did was speaking about big data and also about The Lady's Finger, which is an online women's magazine. And the poster addresses both of these issues, I think, in a really interesting way. So she writes this. It's quite a long quote to read. My family is almost always all over the place. I am the designated online facilitator. I have 7 addresses and 10 debit cards saved in Amazon. On some days, Google Calendar reads my emails to remind me that at 3 p.m. I'm scheduled to take a bus to Delhi, to Manali, and at 3:30 p.m. I have a doctor's appointment at Malar Hospital in Chennai. I sometimes wonder what these websites think of me. Do I really live in 4 cities at the same time? Is it me binge-watching Bear Grylls for 6 hours on Netflix? Should I be the beneficiary of all the redundant advertising of different utensils I should buy because I ordered a pressure cooker for my mother online? Big data has its flaws, as pointed out by Ralph Schroeder. This was the guest we had in episode 1, in the podcast hosted by Ian Cook, that's me, titled Big Data and the Lady's Finger. Schroeder questions the validity of big data and, in turn, the validity of research that analyzes big data. One of the most important lessons for me from the podcast was to learn to think of data and big data as context-free entities. Schroeder illustrates this by talking about a case where phone records of a particular phone is analyzed. What context would it provide about the data if we knew that 2 people share the phone as opposed to when 1 person uses the phone along with another phone? The job of a social scientist would then be to interface between the data and the society that produces it through their research. And then she goes on and she talks about the second part of the podcast with Nisha Susan dealing with the lady's finger. And this is her conclusion. Maybe big data can't figure out where I am, but it probably knows which political ideology I subscribe to, based on the kind of articles I read. Big data that educates algorithms might aid in building echo chambers around the different binaries that exist in the political, cultural, and socio-economical identities of an individual. While the leftists are busy participating in token protest and talking about Karl Marx and Louis Brunel in their echo chambers, the right-wing parties are roping in the masses with fake news and false panic to form larger echo chambers. When such echo chambers collide, the minorities don't get tolerance. They get trolled. Online activists must break out of these echo chambers if they want to create change where it counts. Anyway, this, along with a bunch of other really insightful posts, can be found on the class website. And I'm going to put a link to that on our website as well. That is it from us today. As ever, you can rate us in iTunes. Please do that so more people know about us. You can subscribe by email, by RSS feed, using whatever client you want to use. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at 4 with a number, Digital Dignity, and on Facebook in the same way. And also the website for fordigitaldignity.com. You can also drop us an email at onlinegodspodcast@gmail.com. I really hope you've enjoyed listening today and you get in touch with your thoughts and notes and whatever. They're always really, really appreciated. And of course, please listen again next time. Ta-ra. Thank you so much for listening to the Online Gods podcast. Online Gods is part of the project Online ARPOL, funded by the European Research Council, starting grant agreement number 714285. The project's PI is Sahana Udapa, who's Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology, Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, Germany. This podcast, like all the podcasts, is brought to you in collaboration with the HOW Network for Ethnographic Theory, my personal favourite network for ethnographic theory. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Goodbye.